Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar brought to you by the ICMA Coaching Program. We're glad that so many sites have joined us today. Our topic is ethics in action, when it's your duty to say no. Ethics really undergirds the whole profession. It's what's the foundation of trust with your organization, with your community, and so it's a critically important topic, and we're so glad to be kicking off the 2019 ICMA Coaching Program series of webinars with this important issue. We have 29 state association coaching partners that help us in identifying wonderful presenters like you have today and the topics that are of interest for their members. And so we're glad to have all those participating. And we have 9 outreach partners that assist us in attracting a broad, diverse audience to benefit from these sessions. We're thankful to all of them for their help and support. Today's session is really zeroing in on how do you develop an ethical framework? How do you strengthen the framework that you have? How do you grapple with some of the critical issues that are there? And so pleased to have 3 outstanding presenters for you today. Martha Perego is the Director of Member Services, which sponsors the ICMA coaching program. So thank you, Martha, for that support. And she also, importantly, directs the ethics program for ICMA and has been doing that for long period of time that she's been at ICMA, 20 years of really championing these issues, and is a go-to person on these topics. She also has a history and experience of actually working in local government in a number of different roles as a municipal manager and in a variety of positions, and is a credentialed manager through ICMA, and has a master's from University of North Carolina. And then after Martha gives you an overview, we're going to be zeroing in on some key critical topics, and you'll be hearing from Bruce Messelt, and he is the county administrator in Chisago, Minnesota, and he's also the Professional Conduct Committee Chair for the Minnesota City County Management Association. And he teaches on this topic as an adjunct professor, so he's really thinking about this from a number of different vantage points, as well as from the day-to-day practice and through the work of his committee in reviewing ethical issues that come up in local government and advising and taking action on those. So a critically valuable set of information that he's going to share with you on some topics that typically arise. Then we're going to go to Nick Fanan, who is the executive director of Texas City, Texas. It's essentially the city manager role. And you'll be hearing from him on also a series of different ethical issues that he encounters in his role, both as having been past president of the Texas City Management Association, but also in his role through the ethics committee that supports their state institution. Then we're going to be coming back at the end with Martha, who's going to be giving you some takeaways on building an ethical culture in your organization. And we'll be having a series of questions and answers along the way. And I'm Don Maruska, the director of the ICMA coaching program, serving as your producer and moderator for these sessions. So we're glad to have all of you participating with us today. So we're going to go to a series of polling questions. We're very interested in this topic of how many people are attending at your location. This is a great opportunity to have some discussion in your organization about this topic so that you can be figuring out how you want to build your ethical culture and to do that effectively. So take a moment and let us know how many people are there at your location, and we'll be eager to serve all of you as best we can in today's session. We also want to again encourage you to be using the question function to enter questions that you have on ethical topics. If they're of broad interest to our audience, we'll be asking them on your behalf anonymously. So this is your chance to get some questions answered. As Martha will describe, there's also a hotline through ICMA for confidential conversations about ethical issues. But we want to make this an interactive session and have a good exchange on these topics, because it's in the discussion of them that we really find that we have the great opportunity to explore and understand these issues more fully. So let's take a look at where we are with regard to our audience today. We can see that about 3/4 of you are there on your own, and some of you in groups upwards of 20 or so. So very pleased to have all of you participating with us and helping to address this important topic in local government. So with that, let me turn now to our first presenter, and Martha Perego, Director of Member Services and Ethics at ICMA. Martha.
Great. Thank you, Don. As Don mentioned, I'm just going to offer some introductory comments and then let our practitioners, Bruce and Nick, give you some real-world examples of what they're addressing in their organizations. We want to talk about what are the prevalent issues, how do you spot them, and what you can do to build an ethical culture in your organization. Let's see. Okay. So I love the title of this session because I think so often, you know, ethics in action, when it's your duty to say no. And the headlines almost on a daily basis are filled with examples of people who didn't say no. They did the opposite. When faced with an ethical issue, they said yes. And the most recent example I just want to mention really briefly, and I would encourage you just to go out and Google it, just Google Healthy Holly. So here's an example of somebody who's trying to do good. An author writes the book about encouraging children to adopt healthy eating and exercise activities so that they will, you know, develop healthy lives. And she is able to sell almost $600,000 worth of this book that she wrote and self-published. So she offers it to two healthcare companies, and healthcare companies obviously would be interested in promoting healthy living, and especially with children, and so they buy the book. All sounds wonderful, right? Well, both parties in this example, all three parties in this example, did the wrong thing from an ethics perspective. And the reason why is that the individual who authored the book happens to be the mayor of a large city, and she sold over $100,000 worth of the book to a healthcare company who was then engaged with her and her administration in a contract to provide services to the city. An irrevocable conflict of interest that neither party could get over. Was the $100,000 deal an inducement for the company to get the city's work or not? Undermines public trust and confidence in people when you have that sort of arrangement. In the other instance, the $500,000 worth of books were purchased from a major university medical complex, but at the point in time when this individual, the author, was actually sitting on their board. So two examples of self-dealing that were unethical and still in the allegation mode right now, but pretty clearly a huge issue. The mayor has stepped aside, taking a leave of absence. There's an interim mayor, and now the city has to recover and hopefully rebuild trust with the public. So just an example of somebody who should have said no and didn't. You all say no many times in your work, and we know that. So this today is really about encouraging you to identify issues, and then, you know, how do you resolve them? So ICMA has been at this for 95 years. We wrote a code of ethics way back in the day. We've revised it. We provide support to our members, but really our goal is to get everyone in local government committed to the highest standards of values and ethics so that you can do your work effectively and not run into issues. I like to think about ethics really values-based, not rules-based. The laws and regulations and policies even that you have in your organization, we'll talk about policies, are really important. But what we're trying to do is think about what are the values of public service, the highest level of conduct possible, and it would encourage people when they're looking at complex issues or simple issues, not to be rules driven, but to be thinking about the values that should guide their conduct. So I like this simple, think about it as your GPS. What are your values? How do they align with the organization's expectations of you? How do they align to your professional requirements? Because you may be a member of ICMA who's covered by ICMA's code. You may be a police officer or a police chief who's covered by an entirely different professional set of regulations. So it's incumbent upon you to be able to figure out, how do I align all those values so that my conduct not just meets the rules and regulations and the law, but is so high that it really instills confidence in public, in the public that you serve. ICMA recently was interested in thinking about what are organizations doing, what are the prevalent issues of the day, how are they addressing them, how are they working to build an ethical culture. So we did a survey, and a copy of the article that addresses the survey is actually included in your packet. But we identified some prevalent issues that we think local governments are dealing with on a regular basis, whether it's social media or conflicts of interest. These are things that we hear from our members that are of significant interest to them. I mean, they're calling us saying, how do we deal with this issue with elected officials or this issue with our staff members? And so we ask people, are these the prevalent issues of the day? And if so, are you addressing them in your policies and procedures? You know, again, it's important to give staff advice on, you know, what do I do if I have this situation? So it was, the results were pretty interesting. And oops, I went too fast. Can I go back? Okay. Thank you. The results were pretty interesting. Here are the issues that are not addressed in either a code of conduct or a policy within an organization. So most organizations obviously deal with internet usage policies, acceptance of gifts, which are common, misuse of public resources, conflicts of interest. The two that I thought were kind of interesting, many organizations don't really have value statements in their code, so their code is probably, a third of them do not. So their code is probably more regulatory than inspirational. And then a third of them don't address social media, which is probably a big gap. And I see that Nick has included a copy of their social media policy in the packet. So for those of you who don't have a social media policy, probably would be good to get one. And I'm going to share with you some examples of some conduct that might really encourage you to pay attention to the social media. Okay. So we talk a little bit about gifts, and if you've ever been at a presentation that I've done, you've seen this slide before. Local governments spend a lot of time thinking about, well, can I take this gift and can I take that gift? And my position is, look, if this is related to your official business and your official position, you should just say no. Now, de minimis things like a cup of coffee, no one's going to say anything about. But part of the issue is you spend a lot of time talking about these things, kind of wasting your time instead of just saying, no, I don't want to do it. And then it also can create the slippery slope. The cup of coffee might be okay, but what about the lunch, the dinner, the baseball tickets, et cetera? So my theory is gifts offered to you in your work are just free cheese and a mousetrap. You should just say no. We at ICMA are seeing, it's, as any other profession has it in local government, we have issues around Me Too as well. And so just encouraging organizations to address workplace culture to make sure that what actually happens in your organization reflects the best values. We at ICMA are thinking about adopting actually a guideline that addresses harassment and bullying in the workplace, because I think it's an important issue for everyone. Just an example about some outside employment that came up. And interestingly, now this is an example of where an organization actually didn't see the conflict of interest and didn't think there was a problem with it. So this is a county manager in a county in New Jersey, not an ICMA member, because he would know better if he were, who is also a political consultant. So outside employment is okay as long as it doesn't conflict with your official duties. Well, being a county manager, we're supposed to be politically neutral, and also having an outside employment that requires you to be a political consultant, which by very nature means you are nonpartisan, you are partisan, not nonpartisan, is a direct conflict. But in his culture, they didn't see it so. And so the people who hired him actually dismissed this as, it's just not really an issue, whereas we actually think it's a big issue. You know, sometimes our individual employees with policies and training will still do things that embarrass the organization. So this is just an example where, you know, some people in the fire service were, you know, engaged in sex on city property, and they ultimately got caught because one of them put it out on social media. And next thing you know, the organization has to rally around and rebuild trust with the public. And when they thought they did the right thing, which is to put up more surveillance cameras outside the building, the newspaper actually mocked them for it and said, look, this is taxpayer money that you're spending when people should have known better than to do these sorts of things. So just an example about how someone's bad conduct can really affect the organization. I went too fast there again. So, you know, it's also interesting that we think sometimes about these issues about theft and inappropriate conduct in the workplace, but we really ought to be thinking as well as all the complex issues that you deal with where you're balancing right versus right values and you have different interests in the community. So this is just a snapshot of a conversation that took place in Arlington County, Virginia, when Amazon was being wooed to come to the county to provide the future economic development and more jobs and diversify the economy, which is all a good thing, but it was also met with backlash from the community where Amazon was going to be moving to because these residents lived in this community for a long time, not as affluent a part of Arlington, and very concerned now that their interests were going to be and their community and their lifestyle was going to be deeply affected by what the county wanted to do in bringing Amazon. So an example of how do you make decisions in the public's interest and a lot of the values that we talk about in terms of transparency and engagement with your residents and equity all play into what are larger ethical decisions as well. Then moving from almost on to the ridiculous, if you don't have a social media policy, you really should. And this is an example that you could find on the internet. This woman who is naked, wet, and stoned actually happens to be an elementary school teacher. I think she's now a former elementary school teacher. What you do on social media in your work and your work life and your work outlets and your personal outlets matter. You know, it's very difficult to work in the public sector where everybody sees what you do. You live and work in a fishbowl. But there could be times, both at work and in your personal life, when you say something that calls into question whether you really should be in the role that you have within your public sector agency. So if you don't have a social media policy, please take a look and see what Nick has drafted, and we have other resources as well.
Okay, well, we're going to go to a polling question here. So Martha's outlined for you a whole series of different ethical questions. We only have space in the polling question to identify a few of them here. And to see which of these are of particular interest to you, we're going to be discussing a number of these in the remaining time. And we're eager to see which are of most interest to you. And we'll try to respond to that. Meanwhile, while that's happening and people are responding to the polling question, we had a comment and a question in, Martha, from one of our participants. How can you best counteract the comments like the one about spending money on the cameras when the employee should have known better? In other words, when agencies spend money on ethics training, when they spend time and effort, when they take extra steps, you know, often people in the public can criticize them for, well, why do you even need to do that or whatever. What would you suggest to agencies as to how to position it positively and to take the higher ground?
Well, when it comes to spending time and resources on building an ethical culture, it's not just local governments who do that. Corporations spend money as well trying to do that because it's really important to make sure that what your employees are doing, what the organization is doing aligns with your mission, your vision, your values, and that, you know, it's beneficial to your customers, in our case, our citizens and residents. So I think time and effort spent on doing things the right way, the how you do it, is important. And I think you see that in the private sector as well and in learning institutions. And I would say on the opposite side, when they don't spend time on this, then you see the impact. And you can think about the University of Michigan issue with their coaching staff. You can see it in a lot of different areas. We're all human beings. We make mistakes. But organizations, I think, have a responsibility to focus on, you know, values and outcomes and how you do things. With regard quickly to the the incident with the fire station, I have to actually say that I think that organization did the right thing because they got out in front of the issue as soon as it was made known to them. So they took steps and moved forward. You're going to get dinged no matter what, but I think in that instance, they tried to get out in front of it. And I think the response, putting up the cameras, was probably a practical solution to make sure that they understood who was, you know, coming into the building. So.
Okay. Well, great. Well, we can see from the responses to the polling question here that conflicts of interest run high is a topic of concern. When we get to Nick, he'll be highlighting for you that he's got a code of conduct sample in the agenda packet for you to take a look at on that topic. We also see political activity. We see social media thing, and there's a social media policy example in the agenda packet. So we're going to try to help you get out in front of these topics and figure out ways to navigate them effectively. And thanks for your interest in all these important topics that are here. So what we're going to do now is turn next to Bruce Messelt, Chisago County Administrator in Minnesota. Bruce, welcome. Thank you for joining us today. And eager to hear how you are navigating these issues, not only in your own agency, but in helping other agencies throughout Minnesota address those in your role as professional conduct chair.
Well, thanks, Don. I appreciate that. I like Martha's global list. It's very true. And of course, it's applicable at almost every local level. What I want to do is just give you three examples of when saying no is the right thing to do. That have come from my career and maybe use those and extrapolate some lessons learned. The first thing we'll do is talk about one that happened early on when I was the first time as a city manager, so fairly young in the profession. And really, it was a case of how to say no when, in many ways, ethical tenants were colliding. In this particular case, looking at tenant one and tenant five, we really talk about our roles as they relate to serving local government officials and also to providing them with good factual information to make decisions. And you counter that with our challenge to keep the community informed and improving the quality and the image of public service. In this particular case, early on in my career, I was serving in Moorhead, Minnesota, which is a community next to Fargo. Together, it's about 250,000 people. And Moorhead ended up being the second city in the state of Minnesota to adopt a no smoking ordinance in all public places. At the time, if you recall the tobacco settlements, a lot of that money was used on public health. Well, the public health discussions became actually public advocacy. And in Moorhead, which is a college town and has a lot of restaurants and bars, the public advocacy was really putting pressure on both Fargo and Moorhead to adopt a no smoking ordinance well before either state would do so. As you can imagine, at the time, those were pretty contentious debates. And in Moorhead in particular, because of the reliance on bars and restaurants, there was a lot of significant opposition to doing this. The issues at play, of course, really run the gamut. Should this be a state or even a national issue versus local cities? How do you protect an individual's right to smoke against the collective rights of others to not have to deal with smoking or even an individual's health concerns? Do you expand public policy into private spaces? And are there limits on those? And then ultimately, how do you weigh the economics of a business versus the public health benefits that are being brought into bear here? And the ultimate question that we are facing is, what is the public interest and how is that best served? The particular challenge that confronted me was the city council wanted to get some input in drafting the ordinance. I was tasked to do some information gathering and some ordinance drafting, and we sent out a survey and a questionnaire to all the restaurant and bar owners. We collected the best sample ordinances, anything a good administrator would do. However, as the culmination of this, there was a lot of discussion about meeting with bar and restaurant owners, hearing their concerns, letting them vent a little bit, and then using that feedback to bring back good information to the city council. When we had the meeting organized, however, we got there, and the local newspaper, who also owns a TV station, found that this was a really big issue, and they wanted to be involved, and they weren't just unbiased on this. They were advocating very strongly for a smoking ban. When we got to the meeting and we saw the media, the bar and restaurant owners felt betrayed by the staff, basically. They felt that it was a setup. They didn't want to be on TV. They didn't want to have attributions to them. And so I asked the media to leave and promised that we would do a debrief afterwards. That was consistent with our understanding of open meeting laws or sunshine laws, but it was also an attempt to honor those ethical tenets. Not surprisingly, I guess, we were taken to task pretty severely. The news article was fine. We had a columnist here who wrote a pretty scathing column talking about that this was only one in three times in his career that he had been forced out of a meeting, one of which was by shotgun. So there was quite an interesting analogy there. The editorial the next day was even a little more firm, asking us to question the ethics that were used in making that decision. The good thing is they recognized the legal authority for us to have a meeting with the business owners, but they didn't think it was a very ethical decision. What were the lessons learned from that, besides getting taken to task by the local media and learning that saying no is difficult? One, of course, is that there is a value in making sure that you're doing and honoring your board's requests. It was also very beneficial here that even though the board was divided on the ultimate decision, they were very supportive of the process and the decisions I made and the staff made to try to serve the best public interest. However, being a new administrator, my first reach out actually was to ICMA and to Martha. And she had gave me great advice and great counseling on how to handle this stress and pressure. Reaching out to colleagues, both in MCMA, which is the Minnesota City County Managers Association, as well as to other respected mentors, really helped as well. The other benefit was knowing a little bit about history and Benjamin Franklin's message, of course, which is never pick a fight with somebody who buys ink by the barrel. And also the former mayor, who was a friend of mine, who said, you know, Bruce, a lot of my meetings are not open meetings, but in order to avoid even the chance of this occurring, go someplace else and meet, which seems a little bit antithetical because City Hall is where city business is done. But if it means you're meeting in a bar and a restaurant with those same bar and restaurant owners, you may avoid those situations in the first place. So that was one thing I learned early on, is that there are alternative approaches to dealing with the issue without necessarily creating ethical decisions or consequences. The outcome for us in Moorhead in particular was that the no smoking ban was passed. A year later, the state of Minnesota actually passed it statewide. And although we were a leader and we took our knocks, it was the right thing to do in terms of public health at the end of the day. Another example of saying no a little more to home was actually saying no to your elected board. This one was a recent challenge that we went through here in Chisago County. And again, it put a tenant one and tenant five a little bit in conflict with, in this particular case, tenant three and tenant four. The focus on three and four is the highest ideals of honor and integrity, and really to merit the respect and confidence of not just your elected officials, but the public. And tenant four, the chief function, which is of all local government, is to serve the best interest of all people. In this particular situation, Chisago County is a collar county to Minneapolis and St. Paul. We are basically a fairly homogeneous rural and residential community with small urban enclaves, and most of our folks here commute to work someplace else. In 2016, a small group of Bosnian Muslims purchased some land and solicited to build a private cemetery here in Chisago County, about 45 minutes from where they worship in downtown Minneapolis. They don't have a residential presence. There are no other significant Muslim populations here. This was a decision based upon economics and proximity so that they could honor their generations as they passed with a place to bury their dead. The challenge and the issues were, of course, at the time, there was an increasing level of hostility towards the Islamic faith as well as towards foreigners. We have legitimate land use control issues versus religious liberty, ultimately falling under a federal law, RILUPA. There again is the issue of public interest versus private property rights. And ultimately, getting a little bit to Martha's point, really an interesting challenge with what is the value of legislative intent versus action and how social media impacts that, especially when it's contrasted against the official record. in our particular case, a very probably normal land use decision became increasingly political and hostile very quickly during that very tough 2016 election cycle at the federal and at the local level. One of the questions, again, is what is one's ethical obligations when it comes to specific practices or activities and when it impacts a specific element or population. The challenge was that as the land use decision went through the normal process, we started to see increasingly racist and hostile messages, both in terms of what was in the official record, but more importantly in the social media area. The Planning Commission had a very large and contentious public hearing, but ultimately recommended approval of the conditional use permit. However, when it got to the county board after a delay, there was a 3-2 decision to deny the CUP. That resulted in intense media scrutiny, data practices requests, a litigation from the Bosnian community, employee whistleblower claims, and ultimately a federal civil rights investigation. Most disconcerting for the county manager is that you represent the nexus of where all that information is brought and where it is weighed and ultimately what decisions are made. The biggest challenge here ethically was not necessarily what the board was struggling with, but how to deal with employees who actually were seeking whistleblower protection because they felt that they had information either through social media or for their own work that bad decisions were being made for bad reasons. I just showed you an example of when you get those nice letters, this case about a writ of certiorari from the State Court of Appeals. Here's an example of some of the social media that we saw. What was disheartening for us was that for anybody who bothered to research Bosnian Muslims, these are not Middle Easterners. This group are actually Europeans. And they came over during the 90s, during the Bosnian Civil War. They were welcomed to many communities, including Minnesota. And after a generation where the sons and daughters grew up as Americans, they are full-fledged American citizens. Now that their parents are aging, they don't have a place to honor them with appropriate burial. So the ultimate culmination of this particular challenge was that we were served with an investigation by the United States Department of Justice for violation of federal law. What happened in terms of an ethical challenge was within all of this social media context, as well as the official record, there was a lot of information. The counsel to the legal counsel to the county board, as well as to staff, was do what you have to do, but do it minimally because, of course, we're under investigation. And so if people didn't ask the right question, you wouldn't necessarily have staff or anybody else providing the whole gamut of information available. It was my choice then to say to the county board that I felt ethically that was not appropriate, that ultimately there would be scrutiny. We weren't going to avoid the scrutiny. And so it'd be better to be as open and forthcoming as possible early on, as opposed to waiting until it's pulled out of us tooth by tooth. The culmination was a large meeting with the Department of Justice, where I laid out all of the information that was available to the county board, the social records that we had as well. And the argument to the county board was that this was a situation where they really felt that if they had their full decision investigated early and it withstood muster, it was a good decision. If it wasn't, it would be better to deal with it more quickly. Some of the lessons learned, of course, is again trying to retain board support when you disagree with them, valuing your employee situation and the ethical struggles they face, understanding that legal does not necessarily mean ethical, and then ultimately realizing that no good deed goes unpunished. In my case, because I was also the PIO, when the board reversed its decision, I was the one who had to issue the apology, go down and meet with the media, and invite our Bosnian brothers and sisters to reconsider a decision and build their cemetery.
Bruce, let me just interject here, because this is a very robust example that you're sharing, and it's triggering a number of questions from our audience. And a core question that it gets to here is really one that you illustrated how you navigated, but I'd like you to expand on a little bit, which is, how do you help elected officials when they technically can do something, legally can do something, but it isn't ethically desirable? You know, how do you phrase that discussion? How do you How do you engage them around that? How could our audience members do that? Because they sort of say, hey, we want to do this, and our city attorney tells us we can, or a county attorney, you know, does. What are you doing to interject here? So can you just talk a little bit about that? I think people would love to get a feel for that. And your last example, I think, is a good one.
So can you check and see if my bosses are on the webinar first? No, I'm just kidding. You're asking a good question. And in this particular case, it was a lot of hard conversations. And these aren't the conversations that we have necessarily in the boardroom when the cameras are rolling. These are your one-to-one conversations with your bosses to say, look, even in your heart of hearts, if you think you're making a good land use decision, and I do have one commissioner who to this day believes that he had every good right to deny the land use request. I pointed out to him that the pool or the water in which the decision was made was so polluted because of things that were said, because of community comments, that there's no way a good land use decision could be made. With two other ones, it was to have that hard conversation about ethics. I had one commissioner who in his heart of hearts, from his own religious belief, did not agree with the decision. But we were able to work through to a point to say, as an elected official, and in this case, because that person's an attorney, that they should follow the law. And his interpretation of the law was that the conditional use permit could be granted, and he voted for it. So it really is that boots on the ground, honest conversations that you have to have with your bosses. The hardest was for me to say to them, look, I'm going to be very forthcoming with the investigators. I'm going to show them the entire record, even if they don't ask for it. Because if they say, okay, you made a good decision, you guys are better off. And ultimately, there was enough trust and respect there that the board understood that even staff members lower than the administrator have a federal protection under whistleblower, that they're going to do that regardless, and that the board is better off supporting us than trying to gaggle us. We never got to those really intense challenges where there were, you know, threats to employment or anything. But it was a very, very uncomfortable situation for several months.
Thanks for expanding on that.
Yeah, very quickly, and I'll just do number three a little bit as a tickle for later. You know, when other challenges collide or ethics collide, sometimes it has to deal with other challenges. In this case, political activities. I just want to point out a situation where the county wanted to go down and get state bond funding, so we engaged a lobbying firm. And this gets to some of the gifting clauses Martha talked about. But as the administrator, I'm also their chief lobbyist and have to register as a lobbyist. So we were down very actively at the state capitol and trying to solicit support for state funding. The challenge, of course, is how far does that go? During the off season, a lot of lobbying happens not in the halls or in the offices. It happens in fundraising activities. Fundraising activities sponsored by political parties, fundraising activities sponsored by individual members who are running. And so more and more, I found myself being brought to fundraising activities with the chairman of the board or a commissioner, as well as our lobbyist. To be ethical, the first tier of decision was, I can't give donations, but I can pay for my food because our gift policy is very strict. You can't get anything, including Martha's cup of coffee. However, you still get your name on the donor list. And so as a result, I started seeing at my home information for both political parties because, of course, you're lobbying both sides of the aisle. So ultimately, it led to me making a bright line test, which is I just told the board and I told our lobbyists, you know, I'll go talk to anybody at any time over a cup of coffee. But when it comes to fundraising, I shouldn't be there. And that really cleaned me up for my ethical challenge. I didn't want to have any gray area there. And it, you know, honestly, I don't think it hurt our lobbying efforts and probably created a little bit more of a respect for the difference between being a professional administrator and, in this case, legitimate legal lobbying. Overall, some lessons about when it's okay to say no and what you learn. First of all, you have to educate and inform your elected body. If you don't start with that, it's always more difficult later. We've incorporated the ethical tenets into my performance evaluation. We also try to use it in some of our discussions and when we do after action discussions as well. What I has also found beneficial is to make sure the staff and the community are involved in this, whether that's part of their performance goals and evaluations, or whether it's part of professional development, but to have it be peppered into our professional development activities. A lot of our staff are already part of associations with good, strong, ethical tenants, and we should reach out to them, whether that's police chiefs, fire chiefs, engineers. All of us have at least some professional ethical tenants. One of the best lessons I learned is to seek out during the tough times. You feel alone. You feel truly alone, especially if your staff is struggling and you're trying to counsel them as well as get counsel yourself. Formal and informal networks. You have trusted people on your board or in your community, your family or your friends. And in my case, it got so bad, even reached out for employee assistance with counseling during the cemetery discussions. And then I think ultimately the last benefit is then reach out and help others. Be an asset, be a person there. One of the things I've added for today is some case studies. We use case studies in our staff development because it really gets people talking about issues that aren't personal at the time, but it gets that conversation going. And consider doing that with some ethical challenges. Thanks.
We're going to cover a couple of additional things here that Bruce has shared with you, some references and some credits that you can go to go deeper into the issues that he's been highlighting for you. So I want to be sure that you have an opportunity to take a look at those. The tenants that he's referring to and was highlighting, those are the tenants from the ICMA Code of Ethics. And again, Martha provided the link at the beginning of this webinar to where you can find the ethics ebook that's just out, and also the code of ethics and the tenants and the discussion of those tenants. So lots of useful resources and information that are available to you at those locations. So do take a look. And now we're going to go to a polling question here. Bruce shared with you a number of suggestions about things that you can do to address issues and to navigate this both at the personal level. Here we go on the new polling question. So I'd like you to tick off as many of these items as you think would be areas that would be helpful to give additional attention in boosting and bolstering the ethical foundations in your organization. And while people are responding to those and clicking off the ones where they feel there's a need to give some additional focus, we've got additional questions that are coming in. Some people are asking, you know, how do you navigate around some of these questions like you were dealing with where on the cemetery, et cetera, where there's a whole interface of social mores, cultural contexts, et cetera. And how do you sort of peel away all those different elements and community factors to figure out, you know, well, what's the ethical issue and where do you take a stand? Do you want to just comment briefly about that? We get a bunch of other questions too, so just a few thoughts.
Sure. I appreciate that. First of all, I need to tell you that while the war was won, the battle was lost. The Bosnian community, which is a wonderful community, chose not to build the cemetery here, and you can imagine why. So even though at the end of the day they received the legal right to do so, this is still an ongoing issue for our community, as it is for many communities, about how to deal with changing demographics and welcoming new people to the community. I think the benefit was the conversation was started. And in our case, because it got so toxic, most people, I think, realized that it went too far. Now, where do we pick up with that? I will tell you, it doesn't happen in the halls of City Hall or in the county courthouse. It's happening in the community, and we need to be a part of that conversation. So, for instance, our interfaith community has started a conversation about why there was such a fear of a foreign religion. Ironically, at the same time that they denied the Islamic cemetery, we approved an expansion of a Buddhist temple. So there clearly are other issues at play than just even pure religion. It has to deal with our national ethic and our national discussion. But the county board, at least, I think, recognizes that conversation has to happen at the community level and not in the boardroom. But it's still very much a work in progress, and it's not fun conversation sometimes.
Okay. Well, we're going to get back to a number of other topics here. But we want to go next to Nick Fanan. And Nick, we're getting you back on the webcam here. And first, before we do, just taking a look at the results, clearly people are very strong about the educating staff and community. And we'll get back to that a little bit later about how do you educate your community about your ethical standards and so that you have a whole ecosystem of ethics rather than just a silo of ethics in your organization, and as well educating and informing your elected bodies. And thanks for sharing the example of how you navigated that through with your local elected officials. So, Nick, we're welcoming you to your presentation here on ethics in action and the examples you're going to share, some of which are going to be addressing the questions that have come in. And I think I'm going to save some of the other questions to the end and have all of our panelists weigh in on those that are subject to their shared topics and interests here. But please carry us forward.
Well, first, I want to thank you, Don, and ICMA for putting on this ethics webinar. One of the things that we do with the Texas City Management Association is we really want to get ethics out in front of as many people as possible. And I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end as to when I talk about as many people as possible, I'm not talking just those that are TCMA members. So we'll get into that. But again, thank you and ICMA, Martha and Bruce, especially for your preliminary comments before what I have to say. So again, very timely. I think the topics and what we're going to talk about kind of fits with some of the issues that we're facing right now, too. My button's not controlling the switch there, Don, so if you could you do the slides for me. Okay. Our commonly encountered ethical issues, and you've already heard, and I kind of picked these because they kind of dovetailed into what we were hearing, are gifts, and then running for political office, or our role dealing with politics. And the gifts, the next slide there, some of the common things that we see, and I was going to tell you a little bit of story about it, each of these is a lot of times you aren't sure it's a gift until it's probably too late, or how the public may perceive it differently than when it was actually offered or you may have accepted it. And the next slide. A couple of the stories that I want to talk to you about is the has to do with, I'm going to start actually with the ham during the holidays. Being young in the profession years ago in a city, not knowing, you know, that it was kind of traditional that a lot of the firms like to, you know, send things to you. Fortunately, they did not go to my house, but addressed to me was one of these big holiday hams that came in a styrofoam with the ice, everything packed around it. So I kind of looked at it and I thought, you know, I can't be accepting this. So I looked on the return label. It didn't have a company name. It just, but we knew all came from the Honey Baked Ham Company. So I had secretary said, find out who gave me this and see if they won't take it back. Well, there was no way of finding out according to the company. So what we did is I just sent it back to the Honey Baked Ham. Said, obviously you can do something with it, but and over the day or so that it came to us, they said they couldn't take it back and they were going to just have to waste the ham that it had been paid for, and they were sorry for any of the problems. And so I learned a little bit about that, and I'll get into that in a minute. But I had this reputation that even when I went out for lunch, somebody would want to pay, you know, back in the day when I was young, you know, it would be a $6 lunch, and I would just take out my cash, put it down there, say, oh, no, I got it covered. I got an expense account, et cetera. And it seems small enough, but I said, well, no, I guess our waitress is going to get a nice tip because here's $8 that'll cover my share and the and any tip. And so the reputation got out there that I was pretty much saying no. And so one of our board members who was involved, and he actually owned a company in the city that I worked, he shows up. And he says, I know you don't take gifts or anything, but it's just awfully hot out here, and we've worked a lot together, and I want to say you're doing a good job, so I brought you an ice cream cone. And I said, well, and he had already had the ice cream cone. And I said, well, I appreciate it, but I really shouldn't. He goes, well, no, come out here. You always said, you know, only if everybody's here. And I was thinking, like, the whole community. But he comes out, And I walk out into the main lobby of City Hall there, and sure enough, everybody's got an ice cream cone. And he said he was having ice cream cones delivered to all the city employees because he said, I know everybody's got a share in this when otherwise you can't take anything. I was somewhat kind of surprised, but it seemed to backfire. Then it seemed like he went overboard when taking at that time probably about a 39-cent ice cream cone probably would not have been that big of a deal and thanking him for it. And he served on a board, so his business already couldn't do any business with the city, so it wasn't like he was doing anything. But the holiday ham, I also realized, instead of spending so much time trying to find out who the person was, giving it to the food bank or some other group. We have churches here that do feeds during the holidays. That would have been probably a better way to handle it. And then there's always the trips, the events, golf outings. And I was talking to Bruce just prior to this that a city manager in another city, I won't get into any details on it, but they do cruises out of this city, and it's not in the state of Texas. I don't want Galveston calling me up saying that wasn't their situation. But the city and this particular cruise line were at odds and had some ill feelings toward each other over some of the issues between them and their port. Well, the cruise company offered to give the city manager and the mayor a full 7-10-day cruise at no expense. And the idea was, we're going to bring in some of our corporate people. We want to sit down and talk, but we want it to be a very casual sitting, make everybody feel comfortable, and enlighten you as to what we really do and how it benefits and what all is involved in the cruise industry. And this way you can observe it firsthand. What surprised me was the city manager was actually thinking, well, that's a good idea, and was kind of making this play and had put that out in front of the mayor and the council members. And one of the council members said, well, it seems to me if it's really that important, shouldn't the city or you and the mayor pay for that trip? I don't think it would look good to have the others. So anyway, as it heated up and got a little bit of press, it ended up going on to a council agenda where they just voted it down altogether and said, not only should we pay if we're going to do it, but we shouldn't even be going on the cruise and we shouldn't use our tax dollars to be involved in that. So the idea is, why, as Martha brought out, why are you being invited? If it's the general public and everybody's getting a free cruise, well, it doesn't matter if you're on the council or not. But that's not the case. You're being invited because of your role, and there is going to be that little bit of influence going. But what I also want to say is, you don't have to go to the extreme. An ice cream cone, or as Martha had pointed out, a de minimis gift, is not so much to go ahead and take a $6 lunch, as long as you aren't going to lunch every day with the same person and having them pay for lunch. But once in a blue moon, once a year or something like that, if someone comes in and they want to pay for the lunch, maybe you don't have to be so harsh. I always found it's better to say no and pay my own way, and most are accepting of that now. But there is that feeling that even lunches and other things from time to time on a small scale really shouldn't be a problem. And I see that the many states and cities have that same kind of philosophy. You know, anything under $25 or something like that doesn't need to be reported and is not a problem. The other thing I want to talk about real quick when it comes to these gifts is also realize that these companies that often are offering a gift, that's kind of in their DNA. They always provide trips for their best clients to go somewhere. The private sector does that, and it's pretty common. So dealing with the public sector, they aren't necessarily really trying to persuade you in one way or the other. They may really truly appreciate the business and you're one of their bigger clients and they think they're treating you just like anyone else. So part of this, as I found out, is as I was telling people, no, I can't take a lunch, or, you know, really don't send me. And I would send a thank you note now on the hams that come that we send to the food bank that, it really isn't appropriate to send me specifically, but if you'd like to send it to the food bank, that's where this was delivered. I've noticed I don't get the offer for gifts anymore, but I think a lot of it has to do with I didn't try to offend those who were given the gift. I found out it was better just to let them know the situation and how it can be perceived. Next slide, please. What is now coming up, which is surprising me more, is the idea of elections and the participation in elections. We all know that when it comes to elections, we should not get involved in it. Martha's pointed it out. Bruce has talked about it too in his. When it comes to politics, we need to remain neutral. Our job is dependent on that. It doesn't matter if it's a county, state, federal, we should not get involved in those elections. Next slide, please. So hopefully everybody, if nothing else, they already understand that. But if not, when they leave today, do not get involved in the federal, state, or county, or any type of a local election, school board, or anything else. However, next slide, please. There's a new twist. I'm now finding that city managers are getting upset with how things are being run, and so they actually want to run for office. A few years ago, had someone approach me. I don't live in the community where I'm a city manager, and I've been asked to run for school board. They don't have any interaction. Would that be okay? I said, no, it would not. I've had others want to start running for state representative or state senator position. So you think, oh, well, that's the new twist, is they actually want to run for office. But no. Next slide, please. I'm now getting where they drop their membership with the Texas City Management Association, run for office. If they lose, then they ask to rejoin. Or if they are elected, they'll run the 2, 3, 4 years that they're in there. And when they've completed their term or re-election or whatever, and they're still a city manager during this time, and they get out of being on the school board, then they want to pick up their membership again. So is it ethical to drop out of ICMA to run for office and then rejoin afterwards? What I always tell everybody, what is ethical is ethical. And it's what, as a profession, you come up with as your guidelines, in our case, tenets, that we will follow and adhere to. Now, by our membership, we voluntarily choose to allow ourselves to be have an oversight by the organization. By not being a member, it doesn't make it unethical. It just means we have not agreed to allow someone to have oversight over how we act. But our actions are still unethical if we continue to move on in that kind of a vein of saying, well, I'll just come in and out, and it's not unethical then. So we are now trying to educate our membership that if you drop out to run for office, you violated the TCMA ethics, even if you drop out before you actually run for office, and you probably will not be able to come back in. Next slide.
Just before we move on, Nick, can you help clarify about elections are taboo? Do you mean running just for yourself, or do you mean participating as a donor to candidates in elections, even elections that are outside your own jurisdiction for which you are a manager or a staff member or whatever? Can you kind of nuance that a little bit for people so they understand?
Sure. I apologize if I confused everybody. The new twist was where the individual wants to run for office and drop out by being a membership. So they're actually running. What has always been understood is you do not participate as a donor. You don't participate in the election. You don't put signs out in your front yard. You don't endorse in any way, get involved in the political activities for any state, county, or federal elections. You just avoid those. So hopefully that clarifies that, Don.
And for those who aren't imbued with the ICMA culture here, can you just take a moment to explain why that's important? not being involved, even elections and donations to at other levels and other jurisdictions?
Well, as Bruce kind of pointed out, it's that we are neutral. And when you start getting involved with individuals, then they start kind of tying you to the party's philosophy. So they're going to say you're a spendthrift or you're too conservative or you're going to be in favor of these issues or those issues. So you don't want to get tied to those. Also, it has to do with a lot of times there will be interaction between you and some of these other levels. You may say you never really have any interactions with the state, but then when you do have it, they're going to come back and say, well, you supported my predecessor and I had to oust him in the election. I'm not too keen to help out your city. And that actually can escalate all the way up through the federal level. So there's a lot of consequences that are dealt out through the political, as you know, the political world, as well as just that ability to be able to say, I'm neutral. I'm not saying I'm ultra conservative or not. I'm going to give you the best information and allow you, the board, to make the decision.
Okay, that's very helpful. And of course, the discussion while you're focusing on city managers or county executives, these issues also apply to people, you know, if they're the director of planning or have other significant roles.
And I'll be getting to that in just a moment.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, it should, within your organization, it should apply. Yes, sir. Next slide. So Don just kind of did a good little segue into this, is creating the organizational culture. As members of ICMA and TCMA, we're bound by that. But within our own organization, if your organization doesn't actually speak to it, then there may be that concern. In the state of Texas, they're clear as to, you know, on city time, et cetera, you cannot be involved in any of the elections that are ongoing. However, an individual on their own, after hours, especially if they're salary and they're showing that they're clocking in and out, may show up at a political rally or show up at someone's fundraiser. But the concern is then, if it's a local for a mayor or your council member, and you have individuals on your staff, and then that person is ousted by someone else, and there's a lot of anxiety between the two, they may kind of take a look at your organization and start saying, hey, you had a number of people that are out here supporting my opponent. I don't feel that they're going to be that faithful to me. So again, the idea of being neutral really shouldn't just be on those that are members of TCMA or ICMA. We as leaders need to make sure that everyone that works within our organization understands that being neutral is really something that's beneficial for the organization and will help them better perform their job and be trusted employees. Next slide. So what I've always kind of tried to explain to people is, here are some things that you can do. First is set the example yourself. Make sure that you're walking the talk. So not accepting of gifts, not getting involved in the political fray, making sure that you're honest, doing things out in the open, making sure that you speak exactly what you say, be supportive and take the backseat behind the elected officials. Let them get the credit for the work that's being done. All of those things you can surely do through your own exemplification in the way you do. The other is to post a code of ethics in a prominent location in the office. And I don't know if you can see the little square back there, but that's my code of ethics, and it is prominently displayed when people come in. I've had people comment on it. Oh, you've got some awards up, but you also have this here. Tell me about it. And now we've talked about the code of ethics for TCMA and ICMA. Also, speak about the code. Don't just have it displayed. And as I said, people will come in and talk about it. But I also talk about it with employees. When gifts do come in, I kind of let them know that it's not good that any of us in the office should be getting this, and it's better to send it off to those that are more needy and then send a nice thank you and let them know what was done with that. If it's something real small, like a little canister of pecans, yes, we've just opened up in the entire city hall. We put it out at the holidays and everybody knows, and we don't put any names on it, but we thank them, the vendors, but we tell them that it's not necessary that they send us something. We appreciate them doing business with us anyway. And then we also talk about, we look at adopting policies. And this organization that I'm in right now, Texas City, we probably don't have as many as we should. And that's an area that we can work with within our organization. But we have taken those policies to make sure that our hiring is done fairly and based on merit. We take a look at harassment in the workplace. We want to make sure that people feel comfortable where they work, and we have those types of things. We talk about elections. We've talked about the acceptance of gifts, not being over anything over $25, that they have to not only report it to us, but it needs to be kind of displayed that everybody knows within the organization, the mayor and council knows that you've been accepting. So those are some things that come out. And then the last thing I have is establishing a city program, not just policies. And there's a couple of cities that I have to brag on that have actually done a better job. When I was in a previous city, next slide, please. When I was in a previous city, the mayor wanted us to become a city of character. And I didn't know a lot about it, but he'd given me some information, and we started looking into it. And it went by several names, city of character, character cities, character first, International Association of Character Cities. And it was, and most of these organizations were out, or it's actually one organization that uses these different names, and it's out of Oklahoma. Well, it turns out that it was a church-based group that started this for school districts, cities, and private corporations throughout the whole. It didn't talk any about religion specifically, but because it was a church that started this, it made some cities uneasy. And the city that I was in at that time felt somehow there was something behind it. There was no mention of any type of religion, God, or anything else in there, but there was talk about honesty, integrity, morals. It talked about how to interact, a lot of things that you would have in your normal policy, but they had books and training and other things. But that city at that time decided not to because they were a little bit concerned about the group that started up. But I would strongly encourage to take a look at it because it does not include anything. It's not really a faith-based kind of program as much as it was just a group. But if you do feel uneasy, there are still other ways that you can do it. What one particular city has is they put together an employee council or advisory. And I've done this with safety committees, with insurance, to make sure that we were getting the best insurance, health insurance for everyone. So a lot of you probably have done this. But a couple of cities, and one in particular, Serena Breland did it with her city in Oklahoma, is that she actually put together an advisory committee that worked on ethics and created a true ethics committee internally that reviewed situations when people would bring up items and said, this seems a little odd or peculiar, and it would be brought in front of their ethics committee to take a look at. The other thing that Serena did, as well as Paul Hoffman with the city of Bear Lair, Texas, is it's constantly brought up during their staff meetings. They talk about ethical situations. They talk about the code of ethics that they adhere to as city administrators, but they keep stressing the idea of what our responsibilities are as employees of a city. I hate to be so cliche, but that everything is out in the open and that we work to make sure that the public has this transparency, or we have this transparency with the public. So we find that very important. Also, we need to work with our vendors. And as I said, you know, sending a little note to them saying, thank you, but this is how we'll deal with it in the future, so that they have an understanding, because they aren't bad people. It's not the dark side over there trying to corrupt government and catch us in a trap. It's a common practice, and they have a lot of clients that aren't in the public sector, and some of them probably have just not been educated as to how in government the acceptance of gifts may come across the wrong way with some of the public. And then there's, as one of the things the city of Bel Air has, and we'll get an example of it, is the employee commitment. I think that's great. When they bring someone in and hire a new employee, they have them sign a city commitment form there that pretty much says, I will behave this way. I'm sorry, I'm stuttering on that or having some problems getting that out. But it actually has a way for people to see, this is how I'm supposed to behave as a public employee. So that commitment is something that they get up front. And then they bring it up during their staff meetings. They bring it up continually in evaluations, which is another thing the city of Bel Air has. There's certain aspects of that that's actually included in their evaluation to make sure that you're going to be graded not only on your attitude and your performance, but how well your actions are handled throughout the course of the previous year. So those are some of the things that other cities have done. And as I've mentioned, Serena with the city of Pflugerville now, she says she hasn't implemented that yet, but the city of Alvin, she constantly gets out in front of it and she talks specifically about ethics. Let me back up just 1 second. Paul Hoffman says, you know, I don't bring up the term ethics as much as I talk about the situations and how they need to handle themselves. And I think that's interesting because one of the things that I noticed when I've worked with other cities, you bring up, we need to come up with an ethical policy, ethics policy. And right away, it's like councils are like, oh, they're a little scared. But if you say conduct or honesty or these type things, the city is more apt to kind of go into it. So some cities seem to have a concern about the word ethics. But Serena puts it right out front and she says, I have no concern about it. I think we do need to talk about ethics in the workplace. So within her area, she brings that up constantly. I noticed Don has put up the code of conduct that the city of Texas City has. And as you can see, there's a number of things listed there, and it probably could be longer. And I think every city ought to be able to take a look at what is it that is expected out of our employees. There's the example of the city of Bel Air's commitment, and every employee has to sign that once they're hired on. And Don, I think you can go on. There we have the city of Bel Air's evaluation. I just took out the one example there that kind of reflects back to the commitment letter and the ethics. Again, you won't see the word ethics in either of those things from the city of Bel Air. I believe that, takeaways. First of all is the giving of gifts. I want to make sure that you work with your vendors. Realize that as much as we joke about their being on the dark side or whatever, that they really do help our government in many places. So we need to make sure that they understand how we interact with them. And then, as I said before, it's sometimes better not to get too difficult. Don't sweat the small things, but just say no. Most people are accepting of it, but if it's a small amount, kind of move on with it and realize it's trivial. But as Martha has even pointed out, if you have to ask the question, it's probably better just to say no. And as Bruce pointed out, why are you being invited? Why are you getting involved? It's probably because of your role. And if that's the case, then you don't need to be accepting that gift or participating in that. And then also, I want you to realize that ethics is part of the profession. It's not part of your membership. It's not something you can jump in and out of. The membership allows us to enforce it. And I appreciate all those who voluntarily become a member, because there's a lot to be gained from being a member of ICMA, or in our case, TCMA, the network and the opportunity. As Bruce pointed out, let me back up the network. We're the only city manager in town, so you don't have a lot of people you can talk to. So it's great to know that there are other city managers that may have encountered that problem. Build that network, call on people and say, hey, I'm having this situation. I know it's wrong, but how can I deal with this? And get some advice from others. So I think that's important. And then the last point there is to work with your employees and instill this. No, they aren't members of ICMA or TCMA, but it's, as Don pointed out earlier, the planning director, everybody else, how they act not only reflect on you, but it reflects on your organization and your city. How do you want your city and your organization to be viewed? As a very open and honest and transparent city, a city that's dedicated to public service, humbleness, there to serve, not to have any type of a gain or a benefit from being there. But I think all those things are important. And then both Serena and Paul Hoffman said that I can share their contact information. You'd like to hear more about how they've done a great deal of work of making sure ethics is included in their program. Thank you for the time. Again, thank you very much, Don and ICMA.
Well, thank you very much, Nick. Really important information. So we want to take an opportunity for you to think about and reflect on this for just a moment with the polling question about which of these steps would help your agency's ethical organizational culture. And so click off as many as you think would be helpful to advance your ethical conduct and the effectiveness of your community in this critical element. We've got a lot of questions that are coming up from people on a variety of different topics, and we're going to get to those in just a minute. We're going to be going, though, for a wrap-up first with Martha on some key things that you can do to build your culture here, so we'll just give a moment more. Before we finish up on this polling question, want to get a sense of if you were to distill in a nutshell, Nick, sort of what you think is most important in terms of helping to move ethics and conduct and character down in an organization, what would be your short answer to that?
I think what Bel Air is doing to have everyone sign a commitment that kind of encapsulates what your organization is all about, the ethics, the honesty, the service. I think that would be the first thing, and have everybody kind of sign that, and then just keep that out in front of people. Don't, you know, a lot of these mission statements and other things, they're done and then they're put on a wall and they aren't addressed anymore. I think so. And on top of having kind of that statement and bringing people early on when they're hired to understand, it's also to keep refreshing them. It's just kind of known, the more you reinforce something, the better people are at, one, retaining it, and two, then actually practicing it.
Okay, well, super. Well, we're bringing Martha back, and thanks so much, Nick. And we even got a comment in from our audience here reinforcing your key point here about accountability and actually weaving this into the conduct of the organization. So, Martha, we have you back, and thanks for rejoining here and giving us a wrap-up on building an ethical culture.
So thank you, Don. Some of what I was going to talk about, Nick has covered, and I know we have some questions. We have about 10 minutes left. So I'm actually going to take the liberty of going to the very last slide, or second to last slide. And maybe, Don, you can get me faster, the safeguards for your organization.
Sure.
So a couple things. And you can read these slides in here, but to pull it all together, your own individual conduct is governed by a variety of different things, but I think within your organization, you want to come together and have agreed upon set of values. To Don's word, you're kind of creating an ecosystem. It's not just having a code of ethics. It's not just hiring good people, but it's bringing it all together. I was in a meeting a couple weeks ago, and people were talking about crisis and about decision making. And to Bruce's point, if your organization and you and your elected officials have agreement on values, sort of like the pillars of the values, it's also a way when you're in a tough situation to kind of figure out, well, does this decision align with what we said our four or five values are? So it was a very helpful way to kind of frame it around. values. If we agree these are our values, is what we are about to do supporting those values or contrary to it? So going back and thinking about your values, training on ethics, which is conversations, which is, you know, maybe you want to invite me to come visit with you, but it's whatever you can do in your organization to keep this in front of your employees, practical conversations around what happens in the workplace. I do think good policies can be very helpful. Don't ignore, and I have a nice slide on what happens when something goes wrong, but when you hear about something, you want the whole organization to be willing to say, you can peel off the Band-Aid, look at what happened, and figure it out, investigate it, complete transparency, and move forward. Going to cover-up mode is not helpful. When you see something that goes wrong, even if it's embarrassing to the organization, you need to take necessary action. I think, you know, the public may not forgive your staff member for making a mistake, but they'll be far harsher on you if they think you haven't done something that was appropriate to review it, take action, and move forward. Again, that being very transparent about everything that you do in local government. There's no room for secrecy unless it's those personnel matters or things that are really considered by law to be very private. Think about the front page test. How would you use it if it were on the front page of the paper? And then lastly, I would say use your head. So many times you realize you have an issue, or you know you don't know that you have an issue, but be smart about it and treat it like any other kind of problem you would have. And then I would just close out quickly with this last slide, Don. My favorite far side slide. It's, you know, sometimes you just have to do the right thing. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, so just do the right thing. And just quickly, I'll use the kind of example of, you know, you can make a mistake in your organization and maybe it'll prevent you from getting promoted, or maybe you'll be demoted, or maybe you'll be terminated because of a technical mistake that you made. That's one thing, but you don't want to do something unethical, because that's really damaging to your own reputation and could preclude you from, you know, moving on with your career. So when you're faced with an ethical issue, just do the right thing and let the consequences fall as they may fall. So hopefully, Don, I've left enough time for a couple questions if you have any that you want to pose or wrap up, or polling questions.
Sure. That's great. Let's go to a polling question here, because Martha is highlighting in her summary here some key things that would help build an ethical culture, and some things to be highlighting, including the component here on whistleblowing. Maybe while this is going, could you describe, Martha, what you've seen as some effective ways for organizations to empower people throughout the organization to raise ethical issues in a constructive, productive way?
I think the number one thing that can affect this is creating a safe environment for people to talk about it, and it's safe when the leaders talk about it. When the leader is willing to say, hey, I faced this ethical issue and this is what I did, or when someone's willing to say, I made a mistake and this is how I dealt with it. So you want to create an environment where people feel safe to raise issues, and then that whistleblowing reporting and having multiple opportunities and avenues for people to report. If you make them go to their supervisor, the chain of command, you may not be hearing about issues as quickly as you want to. So we really do encourage the third party hotlines and other things where you're encouraging people to report issues.
Yeah, we're seeing from the polling question results here that people are really lining up, especially around support systems, which I think was the theme that we're hearing from all three presenters, you know, really integrating this into how you do business rather than having ethics be a tack on to the whole process. So let's go forward and we'll bring back the other presenters. So please join back in here, and we're going to be covering a few other key resources and points that we'd like you to be taking a look at out of today's session. We've got some post-webinar discussion questions. The most important thing is, you know, what you make out of this discussion for your own agency, thinking about where would you like to give some target and some attention, and to do that. That's important for you as well. We do have a series of resources. Martha talked about psychological safety. You know, we have Career Compass columns that are on the website written by Frank Benest. He has won on psychological safety, a critical element for creating trust and engagement in your organization. And as Martha was highlighting, that's very important. We have a final polling question here, and we'll be also covering some additional questions along the way. We'd like to see how the webinar was of value to you and to your agency. So click off as many items as you found were of value to you or you think will be of value to your agency in applying them. And while that's happening, I want to underscore, Martha, could you share with the audience the availability of the Ethics Hotline, what it's for, how they people who can access it, how they access it? Because I've got a number of questions that people have sent that are very, fact specific and might do much better with a resource like that. And I want to be sure they know about it.
So actually, if you're talking about ICMA, the best way to pose a question that's entirely confidential is just to email me at mparego@icma.org. That's the ICMA hotline. And it is confidential, entirely confidential. Even if you're asking about an ICMA member, it's still confidential.
Okay. So if somebody has a question, a fact-specific situation or whatever they want to run by you, that would be where they'd go. And we've provided your contact information, but it's very straightforward, mparego@icma.org. And thanks for that service that you provide to the profession of helping people navigate these issues. So let's see. The values that came through very strongly on hearing practitioners describe real situations. So we thank all three of you for doing that. Examples are where this lives. And I think you also illustrated by the examples the importance of leaders at all levels having these kinds of discussions, because that's where ethics live. And those are the important discussions that need to be had. So what I want to do here in the remaining moments is to just go around the horn here with our presenters and just ask you to take a moment to share a few takeaways that you'd like to offer, and we'll then be wrapping up for this webinar for today. So let's go first to Bruce and then Nick and then to Martha on this close here, and I would love to hear your comments about what are some key takeaways you'd like people to have from today? So Bruce, a comment or two about that, what you'd like people to remember out of this session and how to apply it.
Well, I really like the conversation about policies and about value structures. But to me, there's two sides of that coin. We need all those activities, but you also have to have the human element. It has to be a part of conversation. It has to be a part of the culture, the day-to-day operations and activity. In our organization, we say often when we look at a policy, it's because somebody's failed or there's some question. It's the baseline day-to-day activities that also need to have ethics involved. The second piece of that is, while it's never too late to have a conversation about the value of ethics, it's important to have those conversations before you're confronted with a crisis or a challenge or a media story. We're always playing catch up, and a little bit of work, I think, in terms of beforehand, really makes a big difference. To Nick's point, when a city manager is hired, if the city manager talks about ethics during the interview process, there's a better chance that the board's going to go, oh yeah, I remember that, than when it comes up 2 years later when there's a crisis. So make it part of your day-to-day activities in your life, as well as the documents and the procedures that you also adopt.
Okay, great. And we'll go next to Nick Fanana. And Nick, would you incorporate in this, we're getting some additional questions where people are saying this is really a tough bind between staff members and elected officials when there are ethical issues. Any kernels that you'd like to add to what Bruce shared with us earlier about how to navigate that issue with electeds?
Well, I'm kind of surprised that people are saying that that's difficult. The first is, regardless of where the elected officials are, we need to be having, as Bruce said, these policies, and they need to be discussed during staff meetings. You need to continually work with your staff to know that they need to take the right road. And as long as the leader of the organization, one, you're leading by example, as I said, but two, you've got their back. Paul brings that up. He's put it in an article. He's talked to others. he lets people know, as long as you're doing your doing what's right, I've got your back. And but that doesn't mean that as a city manager, as Bruce pointed out, bring that conversation up early in an interview shortly after you're on board. Here's how I'm going to act. Here are the things that I've subscribed to. So you need to be sharing that with the elected officials right off so they have an understanding. And that'll bring them into the dialogue. They'll start thinking, well, is that really something that's only for the staff? Or would that not also be for elected officials? I think they'll find in most cases they are aligned. They should be kind of going down that road together. There really isn't a difference.
Okay, well, thank you. And Martha, your closing suggestions about building an ethical culture, and really want to encourage people to read the article that was in the PM magazine that Martha wrote. It's a good summation to share with your staff and with others about this, and some useful data about what are key issues around this topic. But a closing thought, Martha.
Oh, I would just close by saying, you know, that ethics really does matter, and it is about the individual, your reputation, the reputation of the organization. You want to be proud of where you work, but the second part of that is these are really complex issues, and they oftentimes are discussions around right versus right values, and we need to be able to have these conversations in a really civil and respectful way, but it begins with deciding what are the values of public service, what are the ICMA code of values, how do they guide my conduct, and what can I do in my organization. And as a leader, no matter where you are, whether you're leading a team, a department, or you are the city or county manager, you really do need to lead by example and then demonstrate that you too make mistakes, that you too seek counsel and create a safe environment for people to have a conversation, because it can be a tough conversation. So you want to create a constructive way to have it.
Great. Well, thank you very much. So on behalf of the ICMA coaching program, I really want to thank Martha Perego, Director of Member Services and Ethics at ICMA, Bruce Messelt, County Administrator in Chisago, Minnesota, and Nick Finan, Executive Director of Management Services in Texas City, for sharing their ideas, and most of all to our audience for taking an interest in this topic and giving this attention, and hope that you'll take advantage of the agenda packet, which has lots of resources that we've gathered to help you accelerate your efforts in creating communities of character and ethics to go forward in this profession. Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope that you'll join us in the upcoming webinars that we have. These are the next two that you'll see on the slide here, and you can register for those. I look forward to your participation in all the activities and resources from the ICMA coaching program. Thanks a lot, and have a great day.